In 1694, a debt was levied on the British people till the day of judgment at 8% compound interest. That 1.2 million debt is now currently in the region of 400,000 million, the debt. And the interest to pay that, to service that debt, is in the region of 30 to 40 billion pounds per annum. Now, you'll be aware of the closures of hospitals and all these things, but the hemorrhage, that black hole that swallows up all that money, which could be spent easily on hospitals, on the education system, it represents basically more than we spent on housing, education, and on the police force. So just in the servicing, the continuing service of that debt, we're seeing basically people in difficult conditions, hospitals being closed, having to travel great distances when there is no necessity. But I'll let Ken speak about these technical details, because he's far better at it and understands the technicalities better than I do. I'd like to stick to basically highlighting the issues that the Bank of England is the engine that has brought about war and continual wars throughout the world, and it always must create wars because interest is the thing that fuels armaments. If we did not have the arms industry, all the G7 and the G7.5, including Russia, let's say, would collapse, because armaments are the one mechanism by which we put purchasing power into circulation. And as Allah says, the brother recited, if you do not give up what remains of your demands for usury, expect war from Allah and His Messenger. It is a law of gravity. It is as guaranteed that war will result. And I'll show that the secular argument supports the religious argument, because common sense, whether you're studying Marx, who also, remember, said that a worker is also a capitalist, but if you've not read volume 3, you wouldn't have realized that, and you won't be told it, but he recognized that capitalism was a natural order, because people who create wealth have a capital to exchange, but the rentier, the one who lends money, money capitalism, are both in mortal conflict. Unfortunately, throughout history, the rentier, the one who lends money, has always managed to win the argument. Eddie George, in a speech that he went, it was actually the Churchill Memorial Lecture in Luxembourg, he opened, he said, Prime Minister, Ministers, Your Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, Sir Winston Churchill, whose memory we celebrate this evening, was a great Englishman and a great European. It is a very great honor to have been invited here to the 21st Churchill Lecture. I am delighted to be here, delighted but also, frankly, nervous. I'm nervous because deep in the consciousness of the Bank of England is an awareness that it was one of my predecessors, Montague Norman, the governor of the Bank of England, who in 1925 advised Winston Churchill to go back onto the gold standard. That was, I hasten to point out, well before I was born. But our experience of fixing sterling's exchange rate parity in the conditions of that time was deeply unfortunate, another nice way of putting it. And shortly before we were forced off the gold standard again, in 1931, Winston Churchill wrote to Edward Marsh, his private secretary, and Robert Boothby, Lord Boothby as he became, saying, everybody, it seems, I meet is vaguely alarmed that something terrible is going to happen financially. I hope we shall hang the governor of the Bank of England if it does. I will certainly turn King's evidence against him. So here we have the one of the most the better known of the English members of Parliament actually identifying that the Bank of England was the cause of the problem, and it still is, and has been, as I say, since 1694. It is private, it was nominally nationalized, but nobody, not even a prime minister or a monarch, could question the three basic functions of the Bank of England. It is totally private and has been run as a private fiefdom and dominates and dictates policy, which is then carried out by Westminster, not the other way around. Now, Churchill made the speech in the Houses of Parliament on April 32, in 1932. When I was moved by many arguments and forces in 1925 to return to the gold standard, I was assured by the highest experts, and our experts are men of great ability and of indisputable integrity and sincerity, that we were anchoring ourselves to reality and stability, and I accepted their advice. I take for myself and my colleagues of other days whatever degree of blame and burden there may have been for accepting that advice. But what has happened since? We have had no reality and no stability. The price of gold has risen then by 70%. That is as if a 12-inch foot rule had suddenly been stretched to 19 or 20 inches. As if the pound avoirdupois had suddenly become 23 or 24 ounces, rather than how much it is, 16. Look at what that has meant to everybody who has been compelled to execute their contracts on this irrationally enhanced scale. Look at the gross unfairness of such distortions to all producers of new wealth, and to all that labor and science and enterprise can give us. Look at the enormously increased volume of commodities which have to be created in order to pay off the same mortgage debt or loan. Minor fluctuations might well be ignored, but I say quite seriously that this monetary convolution has now reached such a pitch where I am convinced that the producers of new wealth will not tolerate indefinitely so hideous an oppression. Prior to Churchill making that statement, there was a famous economist, a specialist, a man of great integrity and insight, who predicted World War II within less than 25 years, unless Europe and the world changed its system. This was on the eve of the signing of the armistice in 1918. Silvio Gesell made the following statement, proving again that, as Allah says, expect war from him and his messenger if you will not change or give up your demands for riba, for interest. It was quoted in Zeitung am Mittag, a German newspaper, and he said, in spite of the holy promises of people to banish war once and for all, in spite of the cry of millions, never again war, and in spite of the hopes for a better future, I have this to say. If the present monetary system based on interest and compound interest remains in operation, I dare to predict today that it will take less than 25 years until we have another even worse and new war. I can foresee the coming development clearly. The present degree of technological advancement will quickly result in a record performance of industry. The buildup of capital will be fast in spite of the enormous losses during the war, and through its oversupply of money, the interest rate will be lowered until many speculators refuse to lower their rates any further. Money will then be hoarded, causing predictable inflation. Economic activities will diminish, and increasing numbers of unemployed persons will roam the streets. Within these discontented masses, wild revolutionary ideas will proliferate and arise, and also the poisonous plant called supranationalism will proliferate. No country will understand the other, and the end can only be war again. That was in 1918. Clearly, within that period of 25 years, Churchill, we went on to the gold standard. We, in conjunction, the Bank of England, in conjunction with the Federal Reserve of America, depressed the market in Europe, and as a result of the unemployed caused in Germany, 6 million unemployed, on whose back Hitler climbed to power through the ballot box. But the depressed condition was caused by Karun or Ibn Karun, the banking system, which brought about the conditions which could then exercise to their own advantage. Napoleon, as I mentioned earlier, recognized that there was a serious problem, and he, contrary to what we have been taught, because the victors wrote the history, he recognized that interest was the great enemy of humanity. He said, when he saw the graph, the debt, the graph of interest and compound interest that France owed, he said, it is amazing that this monster interest has not devoured the whole of humanity. It would have done so long ago had not bankruptcy and revolution acted as counterpoison. By 1808, he had an agreement with the Sanhedrin, the Jewish rabbis in France, agreed to completely prohibit usury, interest. And this was then, the alarm bells were then set ringing in the city of London, particularly in the House of Rothschild, because the main agent and the main person who was allied to Rothschild and the Bank of England, of which basically he controlled, was Wellington. Wellington and Nelson were the two main protagonists of Napoleon, and they set about preventing Napoleon, who by that time was already known to have become a Muslim and taken the name Ali Bonaparte. The fact that he adopted for France then the Code Napoleon is predominantly the fiqh of Imam Malik. About 96% of French law is Islamic. Family law was retained as part of the Roman law, but basically, the entire basis of the Napoleonic Code is that of Islam. They have courts of justice, we have courts of law, which is an important distinction. When he spent time in Egypt, as the book shows, that he clearly had more than a passing interest, and it was not just a device to win the support of the Arabs or the Egyptians, but certainly it was, he recognized, as he pointed out, that if the English were not to be allowed to dominate all world trade, there must be some confrontation between it to prevent what is now happening with MAI and the global, this so-called free market. The free market is only free for America and those who will support its interests. The other point that that we know about, where there was an absence of conflict and an absence of the battles, is in Spain for almost six centuries. There was a period which part of my family is Jewish. The Jewish side of the family know that in Spain the golden period was for 600 years under the North African Caliphate. So the civilizing effect on Europe came from Africa through its Islamic aspects and traditions, and that which it practiced in Spain, in Andalusia. So the absence of interest is to be found if you look at Al-Muqaddimah by Ibn Khaldun, of which Professor Arnold Toynbee said it is the greatest book written by any mind in any time or place. Al-Muqaddimah is a brilliant book because he talks about taxation in the most modern terms. And he realized what was the driving force. And almost it's clear from the history that there was an absence of riba in the economy of Spain for 600 years, which is why there was peace there. Once that was brought to ruin, basically, then Europe has been in conflict. And as the Sudanese say, you've had periods of European tribal wars worse than we've had in Africa. To go to a point that Ken will touch upon, I'm sure, is the Christian Council for Monetary Justice, of which Ken is the vice chair. There was a report done in Dundee in the early 60s, I think it was, and I'd like to read from this to show that others have come to the same conclusion, that the enemy of humanity, as Napoleon said, is riba, and the findings of the Christian Doctrine of Wealth Committee was in May 1962, and it points out that war is part of the system because of riba. It says, "We believe that the existing system of debt finance, whereby practically all money comes into circulation as an interest-bearing debt, is prejudicial to human well-being, a drag on the development and distribution of wealth, finds no justification in the nature of things, and perpetuates a wrong conception of the function of money in human society. We believe that the virtual monopoly of credit enjoyed by the banking system is contrary to reason and justice. When a bank makes a loan, it monetizes the credit of a creditworthy customer, admittedly a necessary service, But when it has done this, it hands him back his monetized credit as a debt to the bank for 6, 8 or 9%. There seems to be an anomaly here masked by use and want that calls for examination. The true basis of credit is found in the assets of a nation, men, labor, skills, natural resources, and the enormous power for production now in human hands. The creation and the function of money ought to bear a strict relation to those physical facts and to nothing else. Finally, we believe that the existing system constitutes a barrier to peace and disarmament. It involves the trade war with resulting international frictions. The latest banana round is a typical example where a trade war could quite easily, and has always done in the past, led to a shooting war. That's just an aside, but just to realize that there is a trade war about bananas, something that the world might slip into chaos over. It requires the priming of the financial pump through the colossal expenditure on armaments in the Cold War situation. By this means, vast sums are put into circulation without a corresponding production of consumer goods. It seems difficult to deny the assertion made by Professor Galbraith and others that without the expansion of the economy in this way, there will be economic collapse in the USA and in this country. Since we are confident that it is not beyond the wit of man to devise a system from which these features would be absent, we would urge that it is an imperative Christian duty to press for an introduction of such a system. 1962, we're now in 1999, and nothing has changed. That is still the situation. The Cold War may have gone away, but it was just a smokescreen. There was never any real conflict between Russia and the West. We were bailing them out, and it was a convenient enemy to say, look how bad it is over there. So we were actually never questioning how bad it was here or other people. At that point, I think I'll let Ken come in. I just wanted to put down a few things so you can find that there is great common bonds between us, and also there are a number of Jewish brothers that we know who also recognize that usury is the enemy for them. And if you've heard of Netzarai Charta, they are an Orthodox group of Jews, some of who are members of the PLO, because they say the State of Israel should not be established until the Messiah comes. But I'd just like to quote my favorite, or one of the favorites, who is John Ruskin. And if you want an analysis, this was done in about 1870 or thereabouts, but there's a beautiful description of what usury is. He was denied becoming the Archbishop of Canterbury because of his views on usury. William Temple was another who came along later. But he says, John Ruskin, the dullest of all excuses is for usury is that some kind of good is done by the usurer. Nobody denies the good, but the principle of righteous dealing is that if the good costs you nothing, you must be paid nothing for doing it. Your friend passes your door on an unexpectedly wet day, unprovided for the occasion. You have the choice of three benevolences to him: lending him your umbrella, lending him 18 pence for the cab, or letting him stay in your parlor till the rain is over. If you charge him interest on the umbrella, it is profit on capital. If you charge him interest on the 18 pence, it is ordinary usury. And if you charge him interest on the parlor, it is rent, and all three are equally forbidden by Christian law, being actually worse, because more plausible and hypocritical sins, than if you had at once plainly refused your friend shelter, umbrella, or the pence. You feel yourself to be a brute in the one case, and may someday repent into grace. In the other, you imagine yourself to be an amiable person, rewarded by heaven for your charity, as a result of which the whole of society becomes rotten to the core. We're seeing in this society the results of the rottenness. We're seeing now the growth of conflict and random killings and all the things, if we know from the book of Revelations or we know from the hadith of Rasulullah and even of St. Nihilus, the predictions about what are happening now are very clear. I'll let Ken have his an opportunity to follow on from where I am, and we'll be open to questions and maybe some comment later. Thank you very much. Well, to hear David talk, you'd think that there was no hope. But in actual fact, David really has only scratched the surface of what appears to be wrong with our society. It has been going on for a long time, and it looks as though the good guys keep on losing the battles. I'm not English, I'm British, but let's pretend I'm English. The history I was taught, was about Napoleon, for instance, being this monster who wanted to take over the world, and he had to be fought, otherwise he'd come over and want to take us over. Well, it's only when you start to look into this history, and there's a lot of it, that you begin to discover that much of it is propaganda. David has said quite clearly, history is written by the winners. Exactly so. In a college like this, I'm sure you know, for instance, of a man called Acton, Lord Acton, who said, and I'm sure you'll remember this particular bit, power corrupts, absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely, but he also went on to say that the battle that has swept down through the centuries and that will have to be fought sooner or later is the people versus the banks. Now I'm glad he didn't say bankers, because if you listen to us without thinking about what we're trying to say to you, is you think that we want to take them out like Churchill did and hang them all.
Yes.
Well, thank you. Oh, I'm sorry, I haven't the energy, there's too many of them. But when you actually look at our bankers, you'll find that they too don't actually benefit from our system. And when you think to yourself, well, who does? I don't know how many people do, and it must be tiny. Wherever you look at the results of the way we people, because remember, we're talking about something which man-made. God, Allah, gave us wealth. Wealth in abundance out there for our use. Because we used the brain that God, Allah, gave us, we invented a concept called money to save us from the difficulties of barter, because barter started getting rather difficult. Once we started to get more sophisticated, and I always use the example that within barter, you don't know how many chickens change you want for a cow, and in any case, I want a pair of shoes. So we invented this concept called money. It's a marvelous concept, and it really belongs to us, the people. But unfortunately, a private monopoly has captured this control of money. Not just the issuing, you know, the pushing it around, because in the days when David was talking about where Moses came back down from the mountain, he hadn't been gone more than 5 minutes, and there they were, worshipping the golden calf. In those days, money actually had got a tangible existence. And people say to me, Ken, oh, come on, you're talking about today as though we were back in those days. But my argument, and the argument of many other people like me, is that the principles remain the same. Money stands as a medium of exchange. That's what we invented for ourselves. It works, it's beautiful, it helps us to allow these transactions between us, from trade our surpluses, because most of us are capable of creating wealth. That hasn't been taken away from us, but we haven't got a means of transferring it, a medium of exchange. But over the centuries, people have captured these ideas and said, right, medium of exchange, measure of value. Well, yeah, it's quite reasonable, that. Store of value. Now you start to get into a problematical area. And then, blow me, they started to invent the concept of money which wasn't tangible. And I wouldn't argue that that wasn't a good idea, but we've never had enough gold to actually fulfill our needs as a proper medium of exchange. It was always sort of tucked away for the rich people, and us ordinary folk didn't get a look in. So the concept of using anything, and I normally carry a little bag of cowrie shells around with me, because for hundreds of years and over major areas of the world, cowrie shells, which you can go and pick up off the beach, was money, a medium of exchange. So paper, or even blips on a television screen, don't worry me in the slightest, because they, as long as they perform that function, I don't care what it is. I don't even really much mind plastic, except that powerful people have captured the monopoly of it. And that monopoly now is destroying our societies. We shouldn't be surprised. They then say, well, look, come on, if we're going to give you this, you've got to give us something back in exchange. And of course they're entitled to be paid for their service. They're entitled to charge a service for providing us with our medium, for organizing our medium of exchange for us. They're good bookkeepers. But what they may not be allowed to do, God forbids it, mankind should forbid it, is that they own or claim to own our money and lend it to us at interest. At the head of the title, the introductory page, it talks about Jubilee 2000. Now, I was right delighted when I saw that, because I thought, that's another hook that I can hang my hat on. Because, would you believe that this concept of Jubilee, it must be something like 5,000 years old. God, Allah, in his wisdom, he made us. He knew us. He knew our weaknesses. He forbidden us to take usury from each other, riba, sooth, bunga, call it what you like. But he knew we would be disobedient. So he gave us what amounts to a mercy. And would you believe, us Christians, and we keep on forgetting things throughout our history, we Christians, we've forgotten, for instance, that for 1,500 years we'd stood against usury, and the last 300 or 400 years we'd given way, and it needed Muslims to come and remind us. Christians suddenly rediscovered this concept of Jubilee and started saying, the third world are up to there in debt, and we recognize that it's unrepayable. Well, what do we do about this as Christians? We've got to forgive it. And last year, 70,000 people turned up in Birmingham, and I'm not suggesting for one moment that every one of them was a monetary reformer, understanding all the nuts and bolts of exactly what it's all about, but they had a gut feeling that the only thing you can do with debt is forgive it. Now, most of you here are Muslims. Now, where have you read that before?
Yes.
Is that in the Quran?
Yes.
I thought it might be. Forgive it. It's unrepayable. No, I can't read Arabic.
Read English.
No, I can't read.
Oh, this is Swansea, by the way, not Cardiff.
Oh, is it? Thank you very much. What are you told? It is better for you. No, if a person's in your debt, come on, you come and read it.
Yes, it says, if the debtor is in difficulty, grant him time till it is easy for him to repay. But if you remit it by way of charity, that is best for you, if you did but realize it. So to give up the debt is wise.
Right, thank you. So, but in actual fact, Jubilee wasn't charity. It was justice. Because what did Jubilee actually say? Jubilee said, every 7 years, all debts will be forgiven. Every 50 years, all debts will be forgiven. The slaves will be released, because one of the things that God, Allah, told us was that if you're in debt, you become enslaved. And for many people, that meant literally enslaved. Not just you, but your children, and probably their children too, because of your debt. And what's even more radical, Jubilee said that all the land, because these were the real assets of the people at the time, and they got sold to pay off debt, that land had to return to its original owners. That was Jubilee. And we Christians have suddenly rediscovered it. And people are beginning now to say, debt, particularly third world debt, is unrepayable, write it off. But just as in Pakistan, 4 years ago, the Sharia court said, handed down, its superior court handed down a judgment to the government saying, by July next year, you, the government, will have in place an interest-free banking system. Just as what happened with Jubilee is what happened in Pakistan. the politicians, who I would charge with many of them being in the pockets of the money men, the usurers, the bangers, they threw their hands up and said, it can't be done, it's not possible. Now I think that is a heresy. It's a challenge to God, to Allah, because he told us it was possible. He actually gave us models. And by the way, if there's anybody here who studies economics, do you recognize this 7 years and 50 years business? Does the name Kondratyev ever mean anything to anybody? A Russian secularist who suddenly discovered there were things called long waves in 50 years. Very interesting, isn't it?
Short waves.
Right. Do you think that our sacred books had something to say about all this? Yeah. So, what sort of models can we use? Because Christianity, above all, is considered to be good news for the poor, and I'd like to be talking about good news, really. What can we ordinary people do about this? My view is that, first of all, we need to be aware. We need to be aware that's what's being done in our name, and what is being done in our name, and it's not godly. But secondly, there are things that we as individuals and as groups can do. For instance, David and I regularly talk to groups of young Muslims, and we regularly get battered by them saying, but, you know, you're condemning this system that we live in, but I want to get married, and I'd love to have a home. How can I buy a home in this society without getting a mortgage? The answer really has to be thrown back at them, because the answer has to be, you're Muslims, you live in a society and that understands these things, and you can actually do for yourselves what has been done in this country, in this community before. Because if you go down any high street, even in Swansea, and probably even in Cardiff, yeah, you'll find all these big buildings, and they're called building societies. Now, for the historians, I'm sure you know, that those building societies actually started by small groups of people, like you are in your own communities, saying, we'd love to have our own home. How can we help each other to do this? And that's how they started, by small groups of people coming together, pooling their monetary resources, and buying each other their homes. For the youngsters that come to us, to David and I, our message is to them, first of all, look at yourselves in your own communities. Also, they say, well, we can't get jobs. Well, yes, there are things that you can agitate for, and there are things you can actually do yourselves. It must be becoming fairly obvious in the West that employment, as the mechanism for distributing purchasing power, is breaking down. If you wanted to reverse that, it would mean you getting a sledgehammer and going out and smashing the machines, like people in the area where I live called the Luddites. They thought that the machines were going to put them out of work. Some of them did, some of them didn't. But we're now getting to a situation where our ability to produce is overwhelming. You get people who can press a button, and almost without any other worker employed there and then, out comes 10,000 cars. We have not addressed as societies how we turn the productivity of the machines into purchasing power. Now that suggests to me that we've got to talk to that which we've come together, which we call government, in terms of things like a basic guaranteed income, what my own party called a citizen income. And would you believe, David lent me another one of your funny Muslim books not long ago, from an Egyptian whose name I can never remember.
Muhammad Qutub.
Thank you. And what was he talking about? The state guaranteeing income. So that's the thing that you need to think about and start to agitate for. But as for you as an individual within your communities, do you want to know what mortgage means?
Yeah.
Well, you see, David, part of my resume here, and the point of telling you, is I come from Jersey, this is in the Channel Islands,
the native language is Norman, which you call Norman French, and mortgage is actually a Norman French term. Mort, death, gage, grip, death grip. Is that not what a mortgage is? And we wonder why Allah, God, forbade it to us. Sorry, where was I? Oh yes, I know. Yeah, and it's Swansea, thank you. If anybody doesn't get the joke about that, David and I were at Islamic Week in Cardiff a month ago, and there was I talking about being in Swansea, and I wondered why everybody was giggling. I was in the wrong place. No, they didn't. They were nice people, they didn't throw things. Probably 10 years ago, there was a Muslim convert, a girl, a young woman. She came from Northern Ireland, she converted to Islam, she lived in a little town in the West Country called Stroud. And she'd read her Quran, and she'd read other things, and she said, there's a crash coming. Things are not right. But what do we do about it? And she rediscovered a principle called LETS, Local Exchange Trading Schemes. Now these are small, sophisticated barter systems, which work very well within small communities. We haven't yet worked out quite how to extend them into larger communities, but there are now 500 of these in these islands. They're all over America, all over Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, to my knowledge. I know there are some in India, and I expect that there are many others elsewhere, but because I don't speak any other language, I don't even speak English well, but I don't speak any other language properly, I don't know. And what these basically mean is that people have recognized that although they can't, they have difficulty with employment, although they have difficulty with their income, they still have the ability to create wealth. They still have neighbors who have the ability to create wealth. And I'm sure you'll agree that in most societies people do give each other things, but they've discovered ways of actually turning this sort of economy into something which generates community, community spirit, and creates more wealth. So it works on the basis, the purest sort of system works on the basis of this. A group of people come together, they put into a directory the things which they think they can do. Unfortunately, what seems to have happened is that most of these schemes are very white, very middle class, and they're all taking each other's aromatherapy in. But it is my belief that these schemes will really take off when particularly Asian businessmen, because you're superb at business, when you can go down the road and you can buy a loaf of bread on one of these schemes. Now, these schemes have been used all over the world, and David and I are involved in politics around the world, particularly the Islamic world, and in Turkey they're doing this sort of thing. These schemes are capable of being developed into what many people are now discussing, that is local currencies. In Ithaca, in New York State, there is probably the best example of this, where they have actually put a currency into existence. At the moment, it works out at about 55,000 units of this, but over the last couple of years, it's actually mobilized something like $1.5 million worth of real wealth. My own community, Jersey, at least for 300 years, has never borrowed money. You probably have your own governments wherever you come from. They say, we've got to borrow money from abroad. We've got to get inward investment from abroad. Now, if you're being told this in Malaysia, we're being told that in England, you're being told it in Wales, where's this abroad place? Is it on Mars? Well, I would suggest that, you know, we're being told an untruth. No sovereign government needs to borrow. In the Channel Islands, and there are two sovereign islands, Jersey and Guernsey, Alderney and Sark, and that are a bit different. But I come from Jersey. I don't talk about Guernsey very often. It's a bit like Yorkshire and Lancashire.
Swansea and Cardiff.
Swan's in Cardiff. I come from Jersey. The Royal Courts, which is our Parliament, have a duty which they and they alone recognise that they have to do. When the people go and say, for instance, the sea wall's just broken down, there's been a terrible storm, we need a new sea wall, the Royal Courts will say, well, what do you want a new sea wall for? Well, don't be silly, it's washing away the soil, and if we're not careful, it's going to cause us terrible damage. So they've established a need. We need a new sea wall. The next question is, have we the materials? Well, the island's actually built of granite, the whole thing's granite, so don't be silly, we've got, of course we've got the materials. And the example I've used is a sea wall, but it could have been a road, it could have been a school, it could have been a church, it wouldn't have been a mosque then in Jersey. No, you hadn't got there. But it could have been.
Yeah.
It could have been. Whatever was built or done was then an asset on the books. The idea, like we have in the United Kingdom, of you build a council house and it's not paid for 60 years, or like in Scotland, when they built a market hall at the same time as St. Peter Paul's in Guernsey built one, and 156 years later they pulled it down and discovered it, they hadn't paid for it. There isn't any of that nonsense. Whatever they do, it's been built, bought, paid for from revenue over a short period of time, and then there's an asset on the books. And that then raises the question about taxation, because people say, well, you know, Jersey and Guernsey are different because all the rich people live there. It's a tax haven. Well, I've got to tell you that the rich people went there because of the system. The system has always been different. And go on, then tell them the rest of it. It's your story. David says that they go to the Channel Islands to avoid capital punishment. They don't want their capital punishing. Where was I? See what you've done. Taxation. Thank you. Raises the question. People say, well, all the rich people go there, but, you know, it's a tax haven. I say, well, yes, but that's a result of the system. Because the first call on our taxes here in this country, and I suspect through most of the rest of the world where we've imported our system, the first call on our taxes is to pay our debt. And David gave you some of the figures. We actually paid something like £35 billion last year on just our national debt. Now, I come from a little local authority area, much smaller than Swansea, up on the Pennines between Yorkshire and Lancashire, and we're in the middle of a battle at the moment as to how to cut £6 million off our budget items. And it was put to us, everything in the budget is to be scrutinised. And they called me an idiot, as they always do, when I popped up and said, you know, do you really mean every item? I said, yes. Well, how about scrutinising the interest? What do you mean, Ken? My little local authority paid £11 million last year in interest, straight down that black hole. And every local authority is in the same position. Every one of you with a mortgage is in the same position, because when you get a mortgage, you don't buy one house, you buy four. The only trouble is you only get one. I don't know what the total interest figure is paid out of our community here, the United Kingdom. It is phenomenal. But that little part of the United Kingdom, and Channel Islands are part of the United Kingdom, and we're here by right of conquest, because England belongs to Jersey, by right of conquest. Come on, you know about 1066, surely, Mr. Historian. Yeah? The system is different. They do not borrow, they have no national debt. Because they have no national debt, they do not need to tax. And it's why the Channel Islands, part of the United Kingdom, refuse to join the European Community. Not because they're, you know, they're Europhobes and hate Frenchmen.
Not
No, all right. Or Germans. Or even Irish people. Welsh people. They are passionate pro-Europeans. They've always traded with their neighbours. They always... The Bretons, would you believe, are the ones that come and dig the potatoes for us. Passionate pro-Europeans, but they chose not to join the European community because the Treaty of Rome, and much later, worse still, the Treaty of Maastricht, demands that they give up their right to create their own money. Now this is Cora, Corun at work again, seeking their monopoly. So we've got a strange situation where people like me, passionate pro-Europeans, are anti-Euro, not because of problems about Europe, but problems about the system that's going to be applied. Our system that we've got now is bad enough. It's going to be even worse still when the Euro is imposed upon us. But the function of tax is to pay debt. Now, if you haven't got debt, the taxes are low. So in the Channel Islands, no VAT, no company taxes, no death duties, and only income tax at 20 pence in the pound. So, of course, rich people want to go and live there. So, when people say, we've studied all the books and it's terrible, we keep on losing these battles, it goes on and on and on, we're getting deeper into debt, and we're driven into war because the Quran tells us that's the result of riba, usury, sooth, vice, bunga. We're not without weapons. We have to go back to our sacred books, to the models. Because one of the things which attracted me when I first met... did I ever tell you the story about how he and I met? We were at a by-election in Bradford. He was standing as the Islamic Party. I was fighting for, one of the foot soldiers for my own bloke. And I picked up his election literature. And he was talking, remember he mentioned Silvio Gesell? Well, Silvio Gesell's ideas were taken up in a big way in the early 30s in Austria, and mainly southern Germany, and this little town called Wörgl had actually done what Gesell proposed. They put into circulation their own money in their own way. And it said Wörgl, and I thought, what on earth do these funny Muslims know about Wörgl? Anyway, he doesn't live in Bradford, you see, he lives in Sheffield, and it took me some time to find him, and I picked up the phone and I said Wörgl, and he said Wörgl to you too. And it's been downhill ever since, because he has now taught me, because I'm only an ignorant Christian, remember, and Christians are taught nothing about Islam. I don't know much now, but he's taught me a lot. And some of the things which he has taught me, for instance, we have a concept in Christendom called equity, which means fair dealing, really, and we've forgotten it, as I've told you, sort of, ever since Calvin gave us the fatwa. But in the Quran, you've actually got three perfectly workable models, because it doesn't say anywhere, don't lend. In fact, what's the boring bit about, forgive me, the boring bit about our sacred books is you keep on saying, lend. Lend in the way of...
Spend as well.
Spend. So in other words, in your sacred book, you have three models as to how you are rewarded for your lending. But the one thing that the bankers won't have is that the first of those models say not only are you entitled to a proportion of the increase, you've also got to be able to bear any possible loss. Now say that very quietly in the City of London, because that's what they will not have. And it's what we need to challenge them about. Because there are acceptable ways of lending and being rewarded for your lending. And we need to go back to them and study them as to what they mean in this society, and I think apply them. But as individuals, there are things you can do. You can, within your own community, trade. You can trade your wealth. Make inroads into this monster, the mortgage. And I suggest that what it requires is to remember what God Allah taught us. Thank you.